Mick Warhurst.
Weekdays on ABC Radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
We Australians, we love to travel. Doesn't matter where you go in the world, odds are that sooner or later you'll hear an Australian accent. But did you know that our most intrepid travellers don't even have recognisable accents? They largely fly under the radar. And guess what they sound like? They sound like this. Isn't that beautiful? That's the call of the Eastern Curlew. Not flashy, not loud or flamboyant, not broad and Aussie like Australian accents are when you're overseas. Hey, gone. You can hear that everywhere, can't you, when you're overseas? Oh, there's the Australian. But each year, the Eastern Curlew travels thousands of miles from Australia, this is amazing, to Russia, China, Japan, and Korea. They go there to breed, and then it flies all the way home. And unfortunately, things aren't going well for the bird. It's on the critically endangered list. Kate Gorringe-Smith is the creator of an art project called Overwintering, which hopes to raise awareness of the plight of the curlew and our other migratory shorebirds. And she joins me now along with Jennifer Sturzel and Roger Standen, who are also taking part in this beautiful project. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us, Smith.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Overwintering, what does that mean?
It's quite an old-fashioned term. It's not particularly scientific, but I'm using it in terms of going to a warmer place to avoid the harshness of winter, because the migratory shorebirds all go up north and breed in the above the Arctic Circle, but then they come back and they spend the summer months on the shores of Australia and New Zealand, so they can be said to overwinter here.
So they've got the ideal lifestyle. This is the lifestyle we all want to lead. Summer all around the world. Is that what they're doing? Are they out living our best life?
They follow the sun, don't they, Roger?
Exactly, yeah. They're summer to summer travellers.
Yeah. What interests you about this bird, Roger?
They are just the most amazing creatures that can fly. Like, there's redneck stints, 28 grams. They can fly 10,000 kilometres. Flapping their wings, not like an albatross that glides.
No.
They flap all the way, and they do that up to breed and back every year. They're just astonishing.
Astonishing birds, and they're not a glamorous bird. They're not it depends on your idea of glamour, but they're not a showy bird, are they?
Certainly not. Especially when they're down here in their time off, they're drab greys in colour. Any that have the brilliant, rich chestnut colour, they only get that on their breeding period, which is when they leave here and head up to the Arctic.
Brilliant. Oh, they're a glorious bird and they travel so far. I didn't even really know about it until
not many people
looking
do.
Into this project.
Yeah.
Tell us about the project.
So the Overwintering Project, I launched it in June 2017, and I'm a printmaker based in Melbourne, and I really threw myself on the mercy of the Australian and New Zealand print community, which is quite tightly knit, but there are printmakers all around Australia and New Zealand. And I invited artists I said, these are our most endangered group of birds. Not many people know about them. And invited people to go out into their local shorebird habitat and create a print in any original print media. So that's liner cuts, etchings, lithographs, wood blocks, any screen prints, digital prints, in response to that habitat. And then people have sent me two prints, like the same, because they're repeatable because of the nature of printmaking, one to sell and one to exhibit. So, so far about 140 artists from all around Australia and two from New Zealand have sent me prints, and they're on display at Wyndham. But also the print community's just outdone itself, because they've also been exhibitions around Australia already that have been nothing to do with me. People have gone and done their own research, made their own works and held their own exhibitions and involved their communities.
The bird could become Australia's favourite bird. I think The Guardian had a list early last year, and yep, Australia's favourite bird was decided on. But now that we know about this one, well, we can only move forward from here. It is a national project though, Kate, and I've got Jennifer in Brisbane. What were your first thoughts when you heard about this project?
Well, I thought it was really exciting, and it's sort of wonderful to be part of an overwintering project where it's a collaborative project and printmakers can get together, and we have such a range of skills and interests in the environment particularly. So it was a real opportunity to do something to help protect the migratory birds and also protect the wetlands that surround Brisbane on the coast. The Toondah Harbour, which is under threat from development, it's a real concern. Wonderful, I think there's seven types of mangroves there, and of course all the wonderful migratory birds that fly in and feed during the summer months. So it was an opportunity to say something, to speak out, and through our beautiful artworks. And the other areas that we visited were the Torbal area, which is in the Palmerston Passage. And we went with the Queensland Waders Study Group, and they discussed all the types of birds. And Migaloo Press, that I'm part of, we did lots of drawings and documented that. And from that outcome, we've created these wonderful prints. So it was a wonderful opportunity for us.
The artists have obviously been very enthusiastic about this project. Will it travel like the bird, the curlew, travels itself? Is it going all over the world or all over Australia?
My first plan and hope is that it will be that. So I'm kind of in charge of the core exhibition, which has all the prints that the artists have sent to me. And as I organise more core exhibitions, I'm going to have another deadline for prints and people can send more. So the idea is that the print portfolio will continue to grow. So we've just had an exhibition in Moona in Hobart. It's on currently at Windermark Gallery in Werribee in Melbourne until the end of December. The end of next year, it's going to be at Coffs Harbour Regional Gallery, and at the end of the year after that, it's at Burnie Regional Art Gallery. And I'm hoping to fill the gaps between those exhibitions and continue with exhibitions in other states as well.
I'm with Kate Gorringe-Smith, Roger Standen and Jennifer Stretzel, two artists, Kate and Jennifer. And Roger, we'll get to you now. You are the chair of the Victorian Wader Studies Group. How many wader species do we have and why are they at risk?
There's about 35-plus species that migrate to and from Australia every year. They're not all found down here in Victoria, but most of them are. Most of them travel up to the Arctic to breed, but they can't get there in one go. So they have to stop and refuel. For example, in 2009, we banded and put an identifiable flag on a Bartail Godwit in Corner Inlet in eastern Victoria. In 2009, it was aged one, so it had just come down on its first haul. It left on its first migration in 2011, and every year since then in April, it's been seen by a fellow Andreas Kim in South Korea at the same place every year since. So it's since 2011, it's migrated every year.
Oh, does that make you really excited when you hear that he's made it?
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But it spends about a month there with Andreas, and then it moves on, and then most of our birds move through the Yellow Sea, which is where it meets Andreas is on the southern end of the Yellow Sea, so that's between the Korean Peninsula and the mainland China. And those mudflats in there are the critical refueling stop before they make their last trip up to the breeding grounds.
And the breeding ground is in the Arctic?
Yeah, up around the northern. Most of them breed around the northern Russian border,
on the tundra. How far?
It's about 10,000 k's.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
And a lot of them might fly 5 or 6 days non-stop to get to their first refueling station. The complication is that in the Yellow Sea, that's also probably the most densely populated part of the world with humans. So there's a lot of competition for space, and we've lost a lot of the mudflats there, and that's one of the main reasons why we have a declining population.
Why are we losing mudflats? Are we building on them? Are we destroying them for our own needs?
Exactly. The both Korea and Chinese sides have put up seawalls and what they call reclaim the mudflats. It's not actually reclaiming, it's actually claiming them back from the sea. And consequently, we lose that habitat for the shorebirds. And it's really important that projects like what Kate's got involved can expose this story to the broader community, because the waiterphiles like me, there's not enough of us to build the support for protection of habitat. And the sorts of things that Jennifer listed for Queensland, port development, residential development, they're happening around Australia. It's not just the LOC, but it's also happening around Australia, and we need to be wary of it.
Kate, do you see this as an important project to alert people to the fact that we do need to understand that our wetlands and our mud flats
Absolutely.
Are just as important, and they're not considered as beautiful necessarily as our other waterways, but they're just as important?
Absolutely. That's a big part of the problem. It's a lack of visibility for both the birds and their habitat. I think people tend to look at some of these wetlands, which aren't your sort of glamorous golden beach necessarily, and see it as empty. You know,
and
therefore,
it's not.
It's habitat and it's critical. And a lot of our wetlands are internationally significant. And if you think about it, I have a friend who lives in Newport, and she goes down to the end of her street, and she's opposite the docks at Williamstown, and she gets redneck stints, which are these little ones that weigh about as much as a Tim Tam. And if you think about it,
that's a bird.
The redneck stint. So they're the smallest.
Stint.
So the eastern curlew is the biggest.
Yeah.
The redneck stint is the smallest.
Yeah.
And
I'm writing these down so I can look them all up.
And that little unglamorous stretch links us directly to all the 23 countries that the birds travel to. Like, it's part of an international ecology, and the birds are right there and you can see them. And if people could understand that, and many people do, but if they could understand it loudly, then I think it would be a much easier job to preserve wetlands. And I think wetlands is not a great word either. Like,
no.
It doesn't convey very much. Like, it feels kind of soggy.
Well, it is, isn't it?
And, of course, it is. But there's a lot of sort of awareness, but also, I don't know, changing attitudes perhaps around the birds and their habitat.
Yeah, what word would you give wetlands if you didn't like... thought we could make it a bit more glamorous or enticing to people to care more, and they should.
The coastal ones are really what we call mudflats, but it's really the intertidal zone. You know, the area between low tide and high tide, where it's flat and muddy and silty. It's not a lovely not a lovely white beach to go and lie on and sunbake on. Mm. They're mudflats, but that's where all the food is for all the birds. And most people just think of it as, you know, crappy old mud.
Yeah.
Not good for anything. And because the birds aren't there all the time, they're not here much during the winter time because they've gone on their migration, people don't see them as kind of our birds. But they're everybody's birds. Right away, the flyway from here to the Arctic, they're everyone's birds.
Mm. What does this say about our situation here in the world? Watching the journey of these birds, supporting the environment of these birds, it puts everything in a much more global
perspective,
doesn't
it? Yeah, and I did a project a couple of years ago inviting artists who had migrant and refugee backgrounds to make work in response to the birds as well, because I think there's also that side of it, the way they tie the world together, but also the way they can be a metaphor for human migrations, because they do remind us that so many creatures have to travel in order to find somewhere safe to breed and to have a family. And that's quite a lovely and apolitical way to think about just migration around the globe and the movement of creatures and the movement of people. It's been happening since before there were borders, before people had passports. And it just gives us pause, I think, as well.
Yeah. Jennifer, as an artist, what have you learnt not just through your practice, but what have you learnt while you've been creating art about these birds?
I think one of the interesting things is that I think they're so tiny that, you know, they've almost become bigger to us, you know, that once you sort of see them, but knowing what the names are, knowing the distance they've travelled and how significant they are as part of the complex web of life. And I think that sort of has been a really big learning curve. And I think with the work that we've done a beautiful concertina book, which was a collaboration between Fire Station Print Studio and Migaloo Press. And it sort of has that interconnecting with each page of each artist's print. There's 32 prints. They're stitched together, sort of symbolically showing that connection between all the birds and the habitats as well. So creating that wonderful tapestry. So I think it is really that the fact that we have to coexist in the world with other creatures.
Yeah.
And I think it's really promoted that idea. We're not just here in isolation, that we're part of this bigger global community. And even with our policies and our protection, it's not just about what we do in Australia, it's about what we're doing all around the world, you know, that will determine the survival of these beautiful exceptional creatures. So yes, I think that's sort of been the main focus or the main area that I've have learnt the most from.
And do you like doing art about birds? Is it something as an artist you enjoy doing? I mean, they're such intriguing creatures.
Yeah,
they're wonderful. And I think I do painting as well. So I'm thinking I'm going to do some paintings. I have in the past because I live on the Brisbane River, and there's, you know, we've had spoonbills and plovers and all different types of birds as well. But this has sort of opened up a whole new area of, you know, the eastern curlew, the godwits, the painted snipe, the lesser sandpiper,
and the Norman
greenshank. You know, and these are all endangered birds. You know that what we do in the next few years locally in Queensland is going to make a huge difference, and all around Australia. So it's made me very aware of how urgent this is and how wonderful art can be in actually making people aware as an education and also as a pleasure and increasing people's love of the birds.
That is true. Roger, you come to this as the chair of the Victorian Wader Studies Group. What have you learnt being involved with artists on this project? Well, I imagine it's probably not a world you would have normally delved into.
No, certainly not. Kate's been a font of information and inspiration, really, for us. I've been to the exhibition over in Moona in Tasmania, and I was just blown away by the quality. I guess I've got a science kind of background, and art's not my strong point, but I was very, very impressed with the quality of the work. And just for people that haven't had any exposure to it, to be able to go out, have a look, have a listen, have a think about it, and come up with these amazing prints that depict all sorts of facets about their migration, you know, from their breeding ground to the hassles they have on their travels and all that sort of stuff. They've picked out all those sorts of elements. And can I just say one thing that might be of interest to your listeners, and that is that these birds go up and breed on the Arctic. When the chicks hatch, they are completely independent. They feed themselves. The adults stay around just to protect them from predators. So once the chicks are full size, the adults say, "Okay, kids, you're right now, we're off," and the adults start heading down, back down here. The chicks don't come for another 3 or 4 weeks until they've really fattened up and got
their
wing legs, and they head on their own and come back and join their parents down here. Now, that's just mind-boggling.
They join their parents, so they know where to go even though they've never been there before.
They come down to southeast Australia where their parents came from.
How do they know the way? You're blowing my mind here.
Exactly. That's one of the things that attracted me to the Wader studies, you know. They're just incredible creatures.
Incredible. They've got some sort of ESP, magical ESP, to find them mum and dad.
Yeah.
The other fact that I think is also magical and always gets a good gasp from people is when you tell them that these birds, they live quite a long time, like maybe 20 years or so, and they do this migration every year from the time that they're of, you know, breeding maturity. So they fly in their lives more miles than from the Earth to the Moon and back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's extraordinary.
Wow. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It really is. I'm completely blown away. Why do we not know more about these birds?
Well, that's the great thing about Kate's work is that it is exposing more people
Kate's
to it.
Kate's doing a wonderful
that we
job.
Can't do. Mm.
Yeah. All those glamorous birds, they've got enough of the limelight. It's time to get on to these type of birds.
Who needs parrots?
Absolutely.
No, we love parrots.
is 20 years an average age for a bird? I have no idea.
Probably not an average age, but many of them are capable of living 20 years. Yeah, yep.
Yeah, and...
Like out of the 35 species, they range from the 28-gram redneck stint to the 600-gram eastern curlew, and they're sort of different sizes in between. And generally the larger birds live longer, of course.
Of course. Back to the exhibition. Which countries are actually taking action to help protect the habitats, and will they be involved in this exhibition or something like this in the future?
I don't know. At the moment it's just about, because they, the end of the flyway here in Australia and New Zealand is where they spend the largest portion of their migratory cycle. So they're here on our shores from about October to May. So I feel that gives us a particular responsibility to preserve their habitat. And it's also the idea of home, where home is, that they come here, that their presence here is kind of a gift to us on our shores. So at the moment, I'm only dealing with artists in Australia and New Zealand. I did a project before the Flyway Print Exchange, which had 20 artists from 9 of the flyway countries, and that's still being exhibited. I think that to go bigger than that might just send me a bit crazy.
It's a big project, yeah. By the sound of things. Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, thank you all. It's been an enlightening discussion. I've learnt so much today. And I think I need to get a pair of those wading pants, Roger. Is that de rigueur if you're going in as the wader studies group?
You can get a great view of them from the dry land on the edge.
I don't need the pants. I wanted to do it for the pants. That was it. Thank you so much. I've just loved this. I love learning about birds. Yeah, you
and
certainly
just
can,
Kate. One last point I wanted to say was the sale of prints, the money raised will go to fund shorebird research and conservation.
Brilliant. That's great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Kate Gorringe-Smith, artist and founder of the Overwintering Project, which I'm completely entranced by. We've also been joined by artist Jennifer Stretzel and also Roger Standen, the chair of the Victorian Wader Studies Group. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much,
Mick. Thank you. Myth.